Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and Pete, Mr. Money Mustache, is joining me today as co-host. How are you?
Hey, I'm splendid, Doug.
It's good to have you back in the studio. And this is one of the Q&A episodes. And we have several questions, some about long-term FIRE planning, talking about Canada a little bit. You're a proud Canadian.
Proud, yeah.
Dual citizen.
Grew up in Canada. I would say proud American, but I still retain lots of Canadian roots too.
Good clarification. Filled in some gaps. I don't want to speak for you. We'll also talk about where to save pre-tax or post-tax once you cross over into the seven-figure area. We'll talk about cash buckets and allocation and a few other quick topics at the end as well. If you want to have your questions in, the best way to do it is to check out the Buy Me a Coffee and be a supporter, because then you get priority. You could also join the email list, and basically I think we'll be doing this about once a month or so. We'll figure out the schedule. And I have a vision to have an index of all the questions that we've answered, what episode to go to, and then people hopefully won't have repeat questions, or they'll be adding nuance or going deeper into questions we've already answered.
That's a great idea. And you could have links to that exact point in the YouTube
video,
and it would be drive people to the classics to rewatch them or watch them that might have been overlooked. I love that.
Yep. So we'll have to figure out, I've put together a lot of the core pieces of it, but we need to figure out where to put it so people can get to it easily. And then I realize I'm creating a maintenance issue for myself, which I don't love that, but we could figure out a way.
What about using the artificial brains that now exist? Because they can listen to what we're doing and create summaries and find stuff. And
that's
amazing how smart they are.
That'll end up being one of the main pieces. That's how I organized the first bit. I used a Notebook LM, put in all the episodes we already did, and then described what I wanted, and it did a pretty damn good job.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, you can ask, like, where does Doug answer the question about asparagus? And it'll be like, here's a link to it. And it would take a human potentially, you know, half an hour of jumping around in a video to find that.
It would be so hard. Or even, find those episodes when we first mentioned asparagus, which was, I believe, episode 10. I did that research manually just for my own education. But let's get to the question. So first one is FIRE planning, thinking about long-term. Well, I'll just get into the question here. So this is from Casey out of Louisville, Kentucky. I love listening to the podcast and appreciate all the time you put into making it enjoyable and entertaining. So she's 31. She's a mom and wife, and they're grappling with the financial preparation with kids. They have one child. They hope to have 2 to 3 more, and they realize it'll definitely push back their FIRE timeline. And they don't know how to plan for an expensive decade and a half of raising kids. And they're both entrepreneurs, which I think could be important. She works in real estate. Her husband works in online fitness coaching. And again, they don't know how to plan. They don't know how many kids they're going to have exactly. And the other note is they're about 7 years into their FI journey. And this question is one they're grappling with. So what do you think, Pete? I mean, did you consider some of this stuff, and what advice would you give someone who's trying to plan for uncertainty and then long timelines?
Yeah, it's super interesting and shows a lot of cleverness in this couple and this family who are thinking about this in advance, because it's true. Kids are quite expensive, even on the lowest end. They still end up costing quite a bit. And what it really depends on is what type of life do you envision for your children? Like, are they going to be doing travel soccer a lot, for example, like activities that you typically pay for and require a lot of expenditure and driving around and equipment? Or is it going to be more like the farm life where the kids just play in nature or whatever? And whatever of those things is right for you, that's going to be a big effect, right? Like, it's probably a factor of 10, the amount that you can spend on a child, or maybe even more. Like, I remember my kid was the simple local kind of stuff. And he didn't really like joining activities when he was a kid either. So his expenses were just the basics. Like, you got to give him a room, you got to give him food, you pay for any kind of school. We had great public schools here, so no tuition, but there was like childcare when he was younger and just little things like that. And I remember I averaged it out and it was something pretty low, like $300 or $400 a month through his childhood that that's all it costs to raise this child. But then if you're adding in, like, for example, extra health insurance person, you know, an extra slot on your health insurance, and then typically adding more children, it kind of levels off because it might just be a family plan. And depending on what you're already buying as a parent for the family, you can figure that out right now. But I actually, you know, I have some people in my life that are raising three kids right now that are, so I kind of see firsthand what's happening. And the biggest expenses are the extracurriculars for this family. Food can be pretty cheap if you're like a Costco shopper, a Sam's Club shopper, as we covered in the last episode. They still eat though, so you got to budget linearly for that. More kids are just more mouths, but it's not exponential. Might even be a little bit the other way because you kind of share big meals. And then if there's any kind of childcare, like if your careers are busy such that there's not going to be one or two parents around during the days to watch the kids, then it jumps up a whole bunch more because you might be hiring a caregiver, like a nanny, or like putting kids into the childcare where you pay like per kid. So figure that out for you. And so there's typically like there's birth, and then the kids get more and more expensive up to about like 10 or 12. And then they tail off and get less expensive because you're not doing as many things. And then, of course, if you're doing expensive educations for them, like if you're paying for their college, and if you have a vision that they go to expensive ones and have it all paid for the parents, you can add that into your thing as well. So it's really not a very good example. Like, I can't give a good answer because it so much depends on your choices. But I would say the complete raising of a child, if you just want to put a single number on it for one child, it's probably like on the low side, $40,000 from like birth to age 18, and on the high side, $300,000. So, you know, if you're going to have four kids, then you would have to set aside an extra $1.2 million, which actually, you know, if there's two successful entrepreneurs, you can really kind of do that. You can be like, our base fire number plus 1.2M, go. And then you can actually like fully cover four expensive children with just that much money. So there is a finite bound to it, which is kind of interesting. And there's one more thing that I never would have thought of, but now that I'm seeing this with my gal who has the younger children, is they are always going to the emergency room. Like, they're super vigorous, chaotic children. They're in all these sports and climbing trees and doing other stuff. So they rack up a lot of medical bills, even though nothing's been serious, and they always bounce right back. But I'm like, wow. Like, I think I went to the doctor once as a child, and it was because I got like a little cut on my head that my mom was worried about.
Yeah.
But there was no emergency rooms and no surgeries and stuff. And
yeah.
And it was Canada too, where it's public healthcare, but
sure.
It's like, there's such a huge range, and you could potentially spend, if you don't have good health insurance, you could spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on medical bills if you have four kids that are in sports. So keep that in mind too, or get good insurance if you're like an athletic family, because bones break and kids are just crazy. It's the craziest way they hurt themselves.
Yeah.
But it's still going to be less than like, you know, $2 million.
Right.
Even if the worst happens. So if you're making a lot of money as an entrepreneur, you could just plan for somewhere in that range.
So as someone with no kids, I'll mostly stay in my lane on this, but I do have some opinions. Side note, I've never broken a bone, knock on wood. But I had a lot of head injuries. I was bumping my head. I have like scars and I don't know. I was just running around head first into trees. I don't know. I was in the emergency room a handful of times with just 2, 3, 4 stitches. Again, front of my head, back of my head. I don't know how I have two eyes, basically.
Yeah, got lucky. Yeah. I have a little Harry Potter scar from a piece of sharp metal, which is my most recent head injury. Dang. But it didn't need stitches. It was just sort of like a do-it-yourself carefully apply bandage.
Got it. So my couple thoughts. One, compound interest is your friend. So the more you could front load this, the more, I mean, the compound interest will work for you in the future. And I think one of the big things is like, they know they can save a lot and they don't know like how much they'll need to work later. And it's hard to predict how much work and energy you'll have when you're older. I feel like I have less energy and drive than I did before.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm still taking a break from 10 years of harder work and I'm just resting a little bit right now.
That's a big and very valid factor. Is like, your best earning years, in my opinion, are your 20s, typically before most people have kids, because you're super smart and you have nobody sucking your energy away. So ideally make them save a lot of money then.
And the other is obviously, or maybe it's obvious, I'm looking at it from just how much data you have now. And the reason why it's so hard to do this planning is you don't know how many kids you're going to have. You don't know what they're going to be into. Are they going to be athletes? Are they going to travel a lot for, you know, sports and other things, or not? You may have more kids than you think or less. So as you get more information, you'll be able to plan as you get closer to the date. Again, compound interest is your friend, but as you get closer, you could see like, okay, maybe college is not a priority for any of the kids in the family, or maybe it is for all of them. So as you get closer to the date, you could kind of dial it in a little bit more specifically. And one thing that Casey did mention is they, because they're entrepreneurs, sounds like they're self-employed, they are able to scale up and grow their business, or, you know, make more money if they need to. So I think that's one of the most powerful things that you can have when you don't know how much money you're going to need. That's one of the reasons my risk tolerance is higher than Elizabeth's, is I'm an entrepreneur. Like, I think I could create value. And if I need to, I could figure out a way to not get a job again. And like, once I proved that to myself a couple times, I was like, oh, this is fine. Like, I don't need to save as much as like the numbers say. If I need to, if I just have an optimistic outlook, I can figure out how to make an extra $10,000 a year and not have to get another job, which would just not work for me these days.
Very true. And the final point, do you have another point on the kids stuff? I feel like the kids really suck a lot of energy out of you. It's kind of like, my joke is that each child is a full-time job for at least one person, sometimes even two. So if you have like two parents trying to raise three children, you've got three full-time jobs split between two people, plus any jobs that you're doing to make money, which is like, in my opinion, way too much. So be careful about adding kids unless you're already like very comfortable. I'm not saying you particularly, I'm saying in general, anyone who doesn't know what it's like to raise children, you have to assume that it's quite intense. So typically your career suffers and you don't have as much energy to devote to it because you want and have to take care of the kids and they're waking you up in the night and you're all kinds of stuff relating, you know, there's suddenly the school is canceled and you expected them to be in school that day. So all your work goes out the window for the day, which is good if you can afford it and the kids are your priority, but it's very stressful if you needed to be doing well in your career. So just factor that in. And that's why I'm so much in favor of people getting like a lot of their saving done before you have too many children, because then you're not going to end up in a very stressful place when it's too late.
Very good. Thank you for the question. Next is from Marion. So hi, big fan of the show. I've been wanting to ask Mr. Money Mustache about his thoughts on Canada, given his origins there and their free healthcare. We're soon to be dual citizens and often think about moving back there post early retirement, especially for the healthcare. I know he doesn't love to get into the weeds, so I'd love to hear his general thoughts about the country, dual citizenship. There are paths for FIRE folks who want to pursue it, by the way, and what you see as the benefits of living in Canada versus the US.
Yeah, very interesting question, especially because a lot of people at least partially fantasize about being political refugees here. They're like, if the person they don't like gets elected, they're like, I'm moving to Canada, that's it. But it's not all like rainbows and roses up there either, right? I mean, it really depends on what you like and what you're looking for in a country. So I moved deliberately to the US because I like it better here. Because the number one factor for me is nice weather with lots of sunshine, and we have more options for that in the US. In fact, Canada has zero options for nice weather with lots of sunshine. The closest you can get is like Seattle climate if you go to Vancouver, which is an incredibly expensive city. Right. So why not just live in the US, like the cheap parts of Oregon that are just south, or of Washington State that are just south of Canada? Because then you can have that climate with cheap cost of living. Okay, so the real summary is, yes, Canada has free healthcare, but it's not very good healthcare. It's kind of like what you'd get in like Medicare in like a poor neighborhood, where like doctors aren't always available. They keep the treatment mostly for emergencies, and you know, people wait a long time for the optional surgeries and stuff. And I've seen that with both my parents. I've seen that with my siblings. They take care of you, but it's just like England with the NHS, where here you pay more, but you get like full-on executive, like really good healthcare. And in my view, that's actually worth it. I'm happy to pay more for healthcare here, with the exception of like an emergency surgery where it's $100,000. Like there, Canada wins because you still get the surgery because it's an emergency, but you don't have to pay $100,000. And mm-hmm. even the government is only paying like whatever, $8,000 for that. So anyway, that is the factor. Like you can afford healthcare in the United States too. If you just get a good insurance program, if you shop around, it's going to be a few hundred dollars per month per person. And if your salary is higher here, then that makes up for it, right? Or if your taxes are lower, which they are, or if your cost of living is lower here, Canada has very expensive housing and they have higher taxes and the food is like 1.5 to 2 times as much. And if you choose to own a car, that costs twice as much. And like everything is more expensive in Canada. So it more than makes up for the health insurance costs in many ways. So then that just leaves the cultural aspect. If you like the weather, if you like the healthcare, you like the people in Canada who are, to be fair, very nice, the cultural aspect can be better, you know, especially if you're more left-leaning person, because Canada has more like Democrat-oriented politics, mm-hmm. and it's usually quite a bit less corrupt. You know, like Canada is more like a European country where the politicians can't totally be scam artists and start like Bitcoin companies and mm-hmm. like they do here. It's certainly more civilized in that way. But if you're actually living in the US and you don't follow politics like me, like I vote in all the elections, but I don't read the political news every day, this is going to sound a little bit like fatalistic, but I wish it were different, but my life is still great, right? I can mm-hmm. still ride my mountain bike and build my house and have great investments and live a great life in the sunshine. And even though the political news has some annoying stuff on it.
Right. I have only traveled through Canada once. It was lovely. I drove to Alaska. Everything was fine. People are super nice. And it's good to hear a full perspective from you, because I think sometimes people do only focus on one little aspect that they're passionate or upset about at that time. And then they fail to look at the full picture, the realities of like, okay, if you actually move, what are all the costs? Like, is this, if we're looking at it from an ROI perspective and a lifestyle, I mean, the culture and all the little details, everything matters. And it's hard to quantify some of it. And I'm not saying people should only look at the ROI portion financially. There's a lot of stuff that's hard to quantify that you have to consider. But when you do look at it just from a nuts and bolts, like how much you're paying for certain things, it may not be, even though the healthcare is free, it may actually be more expensive if you're trying to get some of those more elective or things that are non-emergencies. You might be waiting for years to get those surgeries,
right? Yeah, like wealthy Canadians always just cross the border and pay cash for specialist services in the US because they can afford it and the service is better here. And like some of my wealthy, you know, extended family members, like uncles and stuff, that's just regular for them. One of my uncles is a doctor, but when he needs specialized medical care, he comes to the US because he'd rather do that than wait in line for the publicly funded one. So it's like not fair, but at the same time, healthcare is a service and you have to pay for it sometimes. So it kind of makes sense that there's going to be people who are willing to take your money in exchange for a better service.
Very good. Next topic is from supporter Rakesh. Pre-tax versus post-tax investing. My wife and I recently crossed 7 figures in the 401k. 60% of that is in traditional and 40% in Roth. Our bridge account, I guess the taxable brokerage account, is 40% of the 401k, so about 400k, and they want to retire early in the next 7 years, and they're wondering what their strategy should be, keep on doing what they're doing now, or invest more in the taxable. And we didn't talk about this beforehand, so I'm curious what your take is.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. This one made me think. And I think, first of all, I guess they didn't mention their age, because that sometimes is a factor, but
let's assume like mid-40s. I can't remember exactly, but
yeah, this is probably the Rakesh that we know, right?
Yeah,
okay.
It is.
Yeah. So the cool thing about the US retirement accounts is that even though they say that they're locked up till 59 and a half, they are not really. You can access them penalty-free anytime as long as you just start the 72T program, as it's called. And there's some other tricks you can do that as well. And then also the Roth has some backdoors where you can get money out early. So my main point is if I were in this these guys' situation, I would continue contributing to the 401ks or whatever you want while you're still employed, because it gives you the immediate tax break while you're in this high tax bracket. So that's like a tax saving that you kind of get permanently, because I assume when you flip off the spigot of income, then you're going to be only drawing a little bit out, so you'll be in a much lower tax bracket then. So it's a permanent tax savings that you get to keep. And plus, on top of that, with 400K in the taxable brokerage account, that's already enough to get you through, like, you know, probably 10 plus years of, even if you never contributed anymore, you'd probably get to full retirement eligibility by the time that money ran out. But even if that weren't the case, I use myself as an example, because like in recent years, when I was making like some substantial income, I continued to contribute to my 401ks, even though I was retired in quotation marks many years ago. It's like I had a few years of income that was made it worthwhile getting a tax deduction. I put more money in my 401k just because of this exact same thought process, which was, hey, I can always get out early if I need it. Plus, I still got my taxable brokerage, which I can use. Plus, I might have hobby income, entrepreneurship income at various times. So if I have a choice of a tax deduction right now, I pretty much always take it, because there's always a trick to get the money out if you need it.
Right. Very good. And I should mention, this is not financial advice from Pete or me. So, you know, check with your professional.
It's so funny, because we are always giving what sounds like financial advice, but it's not. Wink.
Yeah, these are stories.
Yeah, financial stories. Making up.
So I think I would probably say, like, you could potentially go to an advisor to get like a full sort of analysis. I mean, Rakesh, you're smart too. I mean, you could play this out. I would potentially consider not contributing as much into your Roth anymore, even though that's a great mechanism. One thing that I believe I saw from Brad at Choose FI in his newsletter was how much control we have as early retirees to kind of tweak our income and keep our taxes low. So you have a good base of about 400K in your Roth already. That's great. It'll keep growing, and it'll be a lot by the time you're able to access it at 59 and a half without penalty. The other thing you've done is put money in the taxable brokerage account, and that's one thing that people miss. So they end up having to do some different things, the 72T, which it's doable, or you could just take the 10% penalty too. I mean, like, sometimes that's actually better if you look at the math, but I think because you have the three different areas and you have the ability to get to some of the money, you've done fine. So you've taken care of like the major things. So I would maybe like cut the Roth a little bit and consider being able to control your income when you start accessing that money. And really, you potentially could be better off by contributing more to your 401k, maybe continue to, I don't know if you're maxing it out, but maybe max it out if you can, and then put more money into the brokerage account. I'm biased because I think in 2014, we stopped contributing to our retirement accounts for a few years because we were ignorant. So we were like, oh, we can't get to it until we're 59 and a half for our 401k or our Roth. And we started investing in our brokerage account. So something like 2/3 of our net worth or our portfolio net worth is in post-tax brokerage. So a huge amount of flexibility. And there's some benefits in investing in that way, but we probably have a lower net worth overall because we didn't contribute as much into our 401k.
Mixed out on the tax breaks.
Or correct. Out.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so I've had I always maxed out my 401k through my career, but the limit was so low. I mean, it's still kind of low.
Yeah.
That just led me to save the rest in the taxable brokerage account.
Gotcha. And
because I had a high enough savings rate, that just worked out that the taxable one was always the bigger number.
Okay. Interesting. So you ended up in roughly the same. Was it like a little bit bigger, like 60% of your portfolio?
No, it was much more. It was more like 80 plus percent.
Okay.
Because I only worked in the US 8 years or something.
Yeah.
And then let's say the limit was $15,000 a year that you could put in. So you end up putting like 100,000+ into the 401k, and then it grew as well, but stock market fluctuations,
right,
whatever that was. And then so I had several hundred thousand on top of that in the taxable brokerage account because I was saving, you know, saving $100,000 a year in total between the two of us.
Okay. Yep. So overall, Rakesh, I think if you keep doing the same thing, you're probably in a fine spot. You could tweak things and then maybe optimize a little bit more. But I mean, I don't think it'll make a huge difference overall. Yeah.
That's the other good thing is in the FIRE world, a lot of this optimization that we spend so much time about talking about doesn't matter because you always end up having more than enough.
Yeah.
So yeah. Do it if you enjoy it. Otherwise, just say meh and put it into whatever account.
Yeah. Okay.
That's financial advice.
All right. So next is from Misha out of Phoenix. And this is cash bucket and allocation. The right cash allocation in the context of psychology, sequence of returns, portfolio composition, and so on. There is a common thinking of, quote, years of cash in the bank with the usual comfort ranging from 1 to 10 years, depending on who is thinking about it. That said, I have heard little or no discussion so far how income from dividends and interest should really impact that number. So a reduction in cash position due to free cash flow generated by the assets. This, of course, leads down the discussion of portfolio composition, but I think a portion of invested dividend producing equities is often overlooked, and it creates a solid tax strategy with qualified dividends being taxed at a reasonable rate. It also creates equity upside and lowers the need to hold too much cash. Whatever that means is up for interpretation for the individual. And basically, Misha says, what do you guys think?
Yeah.
So what do you think about the cash allocation and holding cash and all that?
Well, to answer her question directly, first is I would totally agree with that, is that you're let's say you're talking about the number of months or years. She said years. The number of years of cash, how much should I hold? I would say the number of years of cash deficit would be what you're really saying. So if you have dividends that cover 100% of your annual expenses, your cash holding should be almost zero if we're assuming the dividends are pretty reliable. Or you might hold like a fraction of a year, like just a couple months worth of cash. Whereas if you make no dividends, then you might hold a bigger cash reserve because you want to be able to cover stuff without selling shares in an emergency downturn. But with all that said, I really think most people do hold too much cash, because if we're looking at the statistics of the stock market returns, like it goes up 3 years out of four, maybe even 4 years out of five, if you include dividends and look back in the last 70 years of history. Also, even if you, like if the stock market does a little crash, and let's say you're keeping a really low cash reserve, like this week's spending, and you just cash out a little bit of cash every week, you're still fine because you're selling such a tiny amount of shares in order to cover that week's expenses. It all works out fine. Like just allow yourself that budget, whether the market is up or down. And on average, you come out ahead because you're leaving more invested. And if you can convince yourself of that intellectually, then in theory, you should not be worried about it. And that's how I do it. Like I keep about 1 to 2 months of money in my checking account. And then I just top it up, you know, little bits of income stream in, which are similar, like dividends and income from like a couple of loans that I have outstanding that are getting paid back from some businesses. And that's enough to cover my expenses. So why hold tens of thousands of dollars in cash, which I know I'm going to get zero return on? Or I'm assuming you do like at least a high yield savings account, so you might get like a couple percent, a few. But it's just not very fun to hold all that for me. It doesn't give me peace of mind. For me, mm-hmm. I just think I'm losing money every single month that I hold this cash. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage people to kind of like fight themselves if they think it's really safe to have 10 years of cash. Like you're thinking about it wrong mathematically. So you should maybe encourage yourself to kind of relax and do the more mathematically accurate thing. If it makes any difference, if
right.
you have so much money that it doesn't matter anyway, like you have $10 million, then sure, keep 10 years of cash in the bank. Who cares? You have too much money anyway.
Sure. But, so as a quick, so, and I, Yeah, like I said, we didn't talk about some of these, so it's super interesting. One data point, I did talk to Mark Troutman, and he's a little older than us. I think he's 60, and he's been retired for like 10 or 12 years. So I think he actually mentioned like he has 10 years, like literally like 10 years of cash, and he's oversaved, and he's like, okay, I feel really good, and I sleep well at night. And one way, I'll kick it back on you, Pete. So I think it's referencing the last Q&A that we did, and you have your mortgage paid off, right?
Right.
Or yeah. You don't have a mortgage, right? Yeah. Or technically, you just bought a new house, so ignore that. But like, you like to not have a mortgage.
Right.
So mathematically, like, that is not correct, right?
Yes, that's true. So it'd be better to borrow, if I could get a 3% loan,
sure,
to borrow and invest that.
Yeah.
And in a way, that's more like holding cash, right? It's like holding a high yield savings account if you have a paid off house.
So all that to say, like, people view the risk differently. So you're like, I want to have the house, no mortgage. Other people would argue, you know, hey, if we're looking at it mathematically, well, your exact argument is just like, something brings some people comfort and it has to be something different for other people. That said, I think I have like 20K in my checking accounts. I think Elizabeth has close to a year of expenses, like in her high yield savings account. So it's not optimal, but we have a mortgage. So it's like, none of us are making the pure optimal mathematical decision, but across the board, like, it probably works out pretty close. Like, we have too much cash on hand, but it makes us feel a little better. You have a, you know, no mortgage. So
yeah. Maybe the only point I really want to make is when people talk about holding a lot of cash, it's because they have this mistaken belief that if the stock market dips even a tiny bit from its all-time high, then you have to like live only off that cash until the stock market reaches an all-time high again. And then they think, well, okay, there was this one time in the past decade when the stock market took 10 years to reach an all-time high. Therefore, I have to have 10 years of cash. I'm like, that's not how it works. Like, you always can sell little bits of your shares. And today's all-time high, or like today's market crash is just the all-time high from last year or whatever, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And you were happy about it back then, so why aren't you happy about it now? So I think people forget the fact that market fluctuates and it's totally okay to sell your shares at any time. The only time it gets really bad is if it's like 2009 and we've just had that biggest crash where the market got cut in half. And if you say, I'm going to sell $1 million of this so I can buy a house in cash right now, like, then you're really locking in a big loss and you would be better off not doing that. But from these little tiny things, like, we're just talking about taking out a bit of money to pay for your ongoing like groceries and utilities, like the typical expenses of an early retiree. Like, it does not matter. Holding a lot of cash doesn't really help you in that situation.
Well said. The other quick point is, over the last couple of years, again, to your point, the market has been good the last few years since we've been retired, and our withdrawal rate is probably under 3%. Now, we're spending what we want to spend. It's great. Life is really good. We're doing all the shit we want to do, and I have more guitars than ever. However, with the markets down, those will be the years where maybe we're spending 6% because the market has dropped by 40%. So it'll be those years where we're spending a higher withdrawal rate because we're spending the same amount, and it just happens to be our portfolio smaller at that snapshot in time. I mean, think of, you know, looking at snapshots versus like you said, I mean, you're only selling enough for the quarter or the month or however you're doing it. You're not selling 5 years of expenses when the market drops 40%. So
yeah, very true.
Okay, very good. Any other thoughts on that?
No, it's good. It all kind of boils down to fear versus logic. And I think you don't have to be perfect. You just have to be aware of yourself and don't let the fear dictate all your decisions, because otherwise life won't be very fun and your decisions won't be very good.
Perfect. Okay, a couple quick hitters here. These are directly related to you, Pete. So, to testosterone replacement therapy. Someone says, this is from Renan. How's the TRT going? I can see the biceps growing from out here.
Wow.
Yeah.
So first of all, the disclaimer is you should not take testosterone supplemental if you're just trying to gain muscles or biceps. That's not what it's for. But secondly, if anyone doesn't know, I decided to try this hormone replacement therapy after noticing like declining energy levels, and my did the blood tests and my testosterone levels were declining with age, as it often happens. So like with the doctor's help, I got a supplementary amount where it boosts me back up to like the age, the amount you have when you're young. And for me, that was a great thing. Like it gave me a lot of energy and motivation back, and my body functions like even better. I mean, I didn't have any problems before, but I just like feeling like younger, and it's not like an unnatural, bad for you steroid type of thing. It's just like a little tiny boost. So you go back in time a decade or two, and it's super common. There's like tens of millions of US men who are doing this in my age group. So it's not meant to be exciting. The only thing I would say is if anyone's looking into it, start by asking your own doctor, because it's supposed to be really cheap. It's just like a really cheap generic drug that you can get. I think I saw it with a good RX discount for something like $30 a month. And there's all kinds of like online clinics that will mark it up a whole bunch. And if all you need is supplementary testosterone or estrogen or mix, which sometimes women benefit from as well, you shouldn't be paying hundreds of dollars a month just to get this. You know, if you're paying multi-hundred dollars for the special clinic, it should be some kind of comprehensive medical thing that you understand what you're buying. If you just need testosterone, it's cheap, it's natural, it shouldn't be controversial. I lost like thousands of blog post subscribers when I published that article because people thought it was like a scam. And I was like, man, I'm just trying to tell you some of my old man stories that are kind of embarrassing to even admit that I'm using this. But people are like, oh, you're off in left field with this big scam. I quit. I'm like, sorry, trying to help.
Interesting. Did they think it was... Anyway, so people could check out that article. We'll link up to it. Is it, it's just an ongoing, like you'll continue to take it? Do you ever go off of it or?
You can. And then at that point, your body kind of like undershoots. And then within a month or two goes back to however you were before you started.
Okay.
So most people choose not to go off it, but there's also not really any reason to go off it as long as you're comfortable with like, you know, you're not having side effects or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just like you've, from the hormonal perspective, you become a bit younger and your body functions accordingly, which for me, I'm happy with that because I like getting as much as I can, especially with a physical job, like being a carpenter. I like getting as much as I can out of my body with a lot of hours of exertion every day.
Cool. Next is solar panels for the hot tub. Oh, it's the same person. Brendan says, why not get some solar panels for the hot tub, which alludes to a previous reference. You were talking about heating up the hot tub and kind of feeling bad about wasted energy because it cools off. And I mean, you have to heat up a 100 gallons of water or whatever. How big is the hot tub?
Yeah, it's about 200 gallons.
Okay.
And the answer is... I totally do this. I have a whole bunch. This is way too much detail for like a podcast, but because I'm an engineer and I was like electrical engineer is one of my specialties, I love energy and gadgets and stuff. So like years ago, I went on Craigslist and I found like this farmer who was selling a whole bunch of solar panels for like $50 each for these huge, huge solar panels. So I bought 20 of them for $1,000. And ever since then, I've had like Pete's... crazy mad scientist solar farm at my house where I'm just using the free power for all kinds of things. And some of it is just heating the hot tub directly. Also, all the hot water in my house was from the solar panels. And I've invented all kinds of weird stuff. Some of them had been a mild fire risk. But in general, like I like solar panels. And the most responsible use of solar panels is that we just have a ton of them on our Phi Collective co-working space building, which powers the whole building. And that's like a fully legitimate building permit approved grid tied system that is probably right now making thousands and thousands of watts because it's a sunny day here in Colorado. So
yeah,
I totally approve of that for science nerds and electricity nerds. Look into solar panels and they're way cheaper than you think if you buy the equipment rather than talking to the guy with the clipboard who comes to your door, the salesman, because they're still trying to sell stuff for like $25,000 for something that should be $5,000.
Yeah.
So,
yep. And Carl, another big fan, I guess he was working on all the solar project when we were doing the show together, but he, he installed it himself right on his roof and had the whole thing. So he did a really nice job on his, so.
Yeah. Now he's built a new house and he's building his own even bigger array on that because he designed it in such a way that it's got like a giant roof
really
facing the sun. Okay. So they're going to have so much power. Like he designed the heating system in his house so that it just makes use of the, it's like an all electric heating and cooling system because he has free power just flooding out of that new house.
So. Yeah. It's super cool looking house. Like I drove by the other day and it's amazing how much like has been done.
Yeah.
So
the Jensens are getting pretty fancy these days.
All right, Pete. So thanks a lot for joining me again. And you have the Phi Collective stuff going on. So we'll link up to that. And we mentioned it in the last episode, but I just want to highlight the virtual membership. So if people are wanting to get more involved, they can head to the Phi Collective. What kind of stuff do they get as a virtual member?
Yeah, we call it a remote member. And it's basically you join, everyone chit-chats on the Discord app. So it's like a community of several hundred people now that are Discord members. And a certain percentage of those are actual subscribing members. And so it's just a way to meet people. And then if you're in Colorado in the Longmont area in person, you get full access to the space. Like we give you the door code and the Wi-Fi. And remote members will typically coordinate on Discord. Like, hey, I'm coming to Colorado at the end of May. Is anyone else going to be around? And then they can make plans to meet up in the space, go for a hike, meet the locals and that kind of stuff. And we make it cheap. It's like $100 for an entire year because we figure they're not going to be using the building all that much. So we don't have to budget for extra space for everybody. Mm-hmm. But it's nice. It's just nice to have a bigger community and meet more people because Longmont's a small town. So there's not enough. I mean, actually there are a lot of people now, but it's always good to cast a wider net for meeting more people.
And quick example, occasionally people come to Longmont to check out the town. Maybe they're nomadic and whatever, they rent a place for a few months, but I think a couple folks just got into town. Is it David? I won't mention last names, but David, I think did he join the collective? And then Haley as well.
Yeah, those are good examples of like some fun new people who are just semi-nomadic, but they've settled for a while. Yeah, if you're a friendly person, the real key is like if you're friendly and like meeting new people and you're going to reach out to people rather than expect them to reach out to you, then you'll tend to do well because everyone wants to meet nice, friendly people. And then, you get some new friends and make some plans with them.
Yeah, and it's a perfect way if you're new to town to like meet a bunch of people, go to the potlucks, and then there's stuff happening. And especially if you're like a hub and you want to organize something, then, I mean, the world is your oyster at that point. So awesome. Yeah. All right, we'll link up to that. And if you want to submit questions, join the email list, check out the Buy Me a Coffee. And thanks for coming up to the studio, Pete.
Always a pleasure. Can't wait till the next time.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. So any big summertime activities you're looking forward to? Any trips or anything where you're like, I'm happy getting into this?
I'm going to do the usual for me, which is a couple of nice camping trips in Colorado, just driving-based ones. I always seek out lakes and places that are kind of off the grid to camp a little bit.
Nice.
And then I imagine I'll do my annual trip to Canada because all the family is still up there. And that's about it. I'm not a super traveler.
Yeah.
So little opportunities to visit people. If they pop up, they'll do that as well.
Cool.
But I haven't really taken advantage of my new house location, which is next to the Denver airport. Like I have this light rail that goes directly from my house to the Denver airport. And so in theory, traveling is way easier and less expensive than it ever has been for me. And yet I've lived there 2 months and haven't gone on a trip yet. So I am looking forward to my first air trip.
Nice.
Since then. My son has done one and he thought it was cool from the new house. And that was great.
So yeah, super convenient versus like having to deal with the parking and the other little headaches that you run into.
I know. So. It's just such a lower psychological barrier to me because I really like walking. So I just put on my backpack. I never carry like carry-on bags. I just travel with a backpack. So I just walk to the train. There's never any kind of clunky stuff. And then just like, you're free, you're there.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Yep. And I was going to say, we have a couple road trips coming up, some more national parks, but we're looking, I mean, we like you, we don't travel a ton currently. We like to get out to novel new places or whatever, but we'll probably get up to the mountains at some point. High country during the hot summer. It's a little cooler up there.
Of course.
And we enjoy it. See some wildflowers, visit a new town we haven't been to. We'll be going to Crested Butte this year.
Oh yeah. Been there. So. Have you ever been to Crater Lake, Oregon, which is also a national park?
No, but have looked and researched extensively, but haven't been there yet. Have you been or?
No, I got cued into it from surprisingly one of those Instagram things that you didn't intend to watch, but it was like telling me all this stuff about the Crater Lake. I'm like, wow, that sounds pretty cool. So then I looked it up and the closest place is Bend, Oregon, if you were going to fly in there, because you can't really drive there from anywhere unless you're up for a multi-day road trip.
Yep.
So I happen to have some friends in Bend, so why not go visit them and then rent a car and go out to Crater Lake as well? So that might be in my future.
It looks pretty cool. Yeah, like you said, it's a couple day drive. So at that point, you're like, you should probably stick around and visit Bend and go to a couple other places. And then it turns into like a 14 to 18 day trip. And you're like, do I want to be gone that long right now kind of thing? So right.
Especially because my son, we still are very close. And so we have kind of a 2 week schedule and I don't really want to be away for more than 2 weeks at a time. So I typically fly places unless they're within Colorado.